Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior years shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. In honor of Valentine's Day, which arrives next week Wednesday, I've chosen several articles about romance from the February-March issue of Reminisce magazine. Several began with a blind date. In addition to romance, the time capsule spotlight shines on the year 1951, and contributors share their experiences with fundraising dinners. We'll start with a word from the editor, Word Associations. Call me a word nerd, but while browsing the online Merriam-Webster dictionary, for work, of course, I discovered that the following words, 3D, audiophile, barn burner, brownie point, coffee break, fast food, lake effect, nerd, scort, tennies, and whirlybird first hit the printed page in 1951. That's the same year featured in this month's Time Capsule. And while it's fascinating to imagine how folks ever got through the early 20th century without coffee breaks, the fast food phenomenon apparently was already in full swing. Whether you were raised on a farm in the city or the suburbs, you probably attended a pancake breakfast, fish fry, potluck, or spaghetti dinner to raise funds for your school, church, or local charity. Events like these bring people together and cement bonds among neighbors, school groups, church members, and local communities. Our readers remember how their efforts made a difference in cooking for a cause. One story tells about a box supper fundraiser that started with food baskets auctioned to the highest bidder. Often, says the author, real dates would ensue. The setup sounds to me like a blind date, the topic of our feature, Take a Chance on Love. And while going on a date doesn't mean that you have to get married, 6 out of 7 couples in our selection of stories eventually did tie the knot. Starting with the spotlight on 1951, health consultant Jack LaLanne began hosting his exercise show from KGO-TV in San Francisco this year. Disc jockey Alan Freed coined the term rock and roll to describe R&B artists such as Chuck Berry. DuPont introduced wash-and-wear Dacron, preparing the way for the 1971's leisure suits. Underground bomb shelters became all the rage, and mothers cried as their sons went off to fight in the Korean War in an effort to contain the spread of communism. So the timeline. January 9th, the United Nations headquarters opens in New York City. January 29th, Elizabeth Taylor, 18, divorces Conrad Hilton Jr., the first of her 7 husbands. March 12th, Hank Ketchum's syndicated comic strip, Dennis the Menace, premieres. April 11th, President Harry Truman fires Korean War General Douglas MacArthur for insubordination. May 1st, New York Yankee Mickey Mantle hits his first home run. May 8th, DuPont introduces Dacron, the first polyester fiber to hit the consumer market. And May 11th, MIT's Jay Forrester applies for a patent on magnetic core memory, the first RAM for computers. May 14th, it's time for Ernie, a network series featuring Ernie Kovacs, debuts on NBC. May 25th, center fielder Willie Mays begins his career with the New York Giants. June 14th, weighing in at 16,000 pounds, UNIVAC 1, the world's most advanced electronic calculating system at the time, boots up at the U.S. Census Bureau. Going to June 25th, premiere, the first U.S. color TV show broadcast in 5 East Coast CBS affiliates, and June 28th, Amos and Andy, the first TV series to feature an all-black cast, premieres on CBS. July 26th, Walt Disney's animated feature Alice in Wonderland premieres in London. It is initially considered a flop. September 3rd, soap opera Search for Tomorrow debuts on CBS as a 15-minute live show. September 11th, American Florence Chadwick is the first woman to swim both ways across the English Channel. On September 13th, In Korea, U.S. Army troops begin a month-long battle at Heartbreak Ridge. October 3rd, Bobby Thompson's three-run homer, the shot heard round the world, helps the New York Giants clinch the NL pennant. October 6th, Joseph Stalin confirms that Russia has tested an atomic bomb. October 15th, I Love Lucy, which stars real-life spouses Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, premieres on CBS. November 10th, the first direct-dial long-distance telephone call links mayors in Englewood, New Jersey and Alameda, California. November 11th, the next day, MGM releases An American in Paris, starring Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron. And finally, December 26th, The African Queen, starring Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, premieres in Los Angeles. Loved that one. And now, an on-air dance party. On the night of July 11th, 1951, a hard-drinking, chain-smoking, gravel-voiced disc jockey brought a groundbreaking new term to Cleveland radio. Let's rock and roll, Alan Freed bellowed into the mic at station WJW. It's the Alan Freed Rock and Roll Party. Caught up in the sound of the rhythm and blues 78s that spun on his turntables, Freed pounded a beat on a Cleveland phone book and rang a cowbell, shouting, "Go, man, go," while the music blasted through the speakers. Freed's exuberant promotion of the phrase quickly earned R&B music a new label. Earlier that year, the classical music DJ met with Buddy Leo Mintz, owner of the inner city store Record Rendezvous. A longtime WJW sponsor, Mintz explained that nearly half of his R&B buying customers were young white teens. Freed could gain a huge new late-night audience, Mintz promised, if he switched his format from fuddy-duddy classical to what teens everywhere were embracing. The savvy Freed quickly adopted the instantly popular mixture of black jump blues, up-tempo swing, and doo-wop ballads as the rock and roll that would soon make him a teenage culture superstar. That was written by Randall C. Hill, who writes about music from his home in Bandon, Oregon. And now let's go to the blind dates and more romance. She wasn't wild about Harry at first, but he kept popping up. Too Embarrassing to Resist by Nancy Furco, Claymont, Delaware. My sister Diane had a date with a fellow, Omalon Misek, for high school graduation dance in Chester, Pennsylvania, in 1963, and Omalon brought his best friend, Harry, to be my date. Harry was a gentleman, for sure, but at 6'1", he was too tall for me. I'm barely 5 feet. He was very skinny, which made him look even taller. He was blonde, and I liked brown hair. We went dancing, and he was good at it, so good that he was doing splits and stuff like that. It was a bit embarrassing. I was having a good time, but it felt awkward being with such a tall guy. We'd pass by windows, and I could see how huge he was compared to me. Harry asked me out for the next night, but I had accepted a blind date with a boy named Tony. He was a lot shorter than Harry and had brown hair. To my surprise, Harry showed up at my door the next night anyway, and we all ended up going to the dance together. It was embarrassing, to say the least, but since we were all blind dates, we weren't invested in each other. At the end of the night, Tony kissed me goodnight, and so did Harry. I asked Tony to my graduation party. We went on a few more dates, but that was it. Meanwhile, Harry would knock at my door now and then, and we'd go for a walk or have dinner. Harry didn't talk much. I wasn't into Harry. He showed up one day when I was ice skating. He had never skated before, but he bought new skates and walked several miles to the lake to skate with my sister and me. 2 hours later, he walked home. My father gladly would have driven him home, but as I said, Harry didn't say much, and he certainly didn't ask for favors. I always knew, however, how he felt about me. In the summer, my sister and I were at the shore with family when Harry and his father drove up towing a boat. We invited them to stay the night, and the next day they taught us to water ski. What a blast! Though it still was embarrassing, because they had invited themselves. By then, though, Harry was growing on me. Years passed, and Harry joined the Army and went to Vietnam. We corresponded and got to know each other much better. Conversation had never been Harry's strength, but he wrote meaningful letters. By the time he got out of the Army in 1970, it no longer mattered to me how tall he was or that he had blonde hair. We have been happily married now for 47 years. Harry is the best thing that ever happened to me. And now he fell big time for that little lady, A Roller Coaster Ride to Her Heart, by Kathleen M. Varela, New Braunfels, Texas. On the 4th of July in 1947, my mother, Dorothy, was not looking forward to spending the holiday with her two little brothers at home in Burbank, California. She was 17. She wanted to have fun. Her friend Faye called to say that her boyfriend had a friend, John, from Montana, who had recently completed a tour of duty in Japan. Now training to be an aviation mechanic, John needed a date for the day. Would she come along? Mom was shy about going on blind dates, but the alternative was worse. So she said yes. They went on a picnic at Griffith Park, then to the zoo, and wound up at the Santa Monica Pier, where there was a carnival. At the target shooting booth, John easily won Dorothy a treasured stuffed animal. As they walked, he reached out and took her hand. Years later, Mom remembered how their hands seemed to fit together. It felt right to her. They decided to ride the Blue Streak Racer. John had never been on a roller coaster before, but he eagerly boarded one of the cars with Dorothy sitting close by. As the coaster took off with a click, 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 she glanced at John, anticipating the first drop. But John looked like he was wondering what he'd gotten himself into. The cars plunged down the first grade and zoomed around curve after curve as the riders screamed and cheered. Back at the depot, Dorothy exited the ride and turned to look at John. Just as he stepped off, he passed out. My 5'5" mother helped my 6'3" father as he crumpled to the deck. She held his head in her lap, brushing his hair out of his face. And as she watched his eyes flutter open, all she could see was how blue they were, and she knew then that this was the man she was going to marry. She took him for a walk on the beach to clear his head as holiday fireworks went off in the background. Faye confessed to my mother the next day that she had tried another friend before she called Dorothy, but got a busy signal twice. Faye never expected Dorothy to agree to a blind date, but she called her anyway. Dorothy and John married on September 19, 1948, at the Little Church of the Flowers at Forest Lawn, California. My two brothers and I would not have been born, and I wouldn't have been able to share this sweet love story if it weren't for a busy signal 60 years ago. And now, not a blind date, but a wonderful story of true love, Reverse Migration, A New Life Began in Her Grandparents' Homeland, by Arvid Berge, Madison, Wisconsin. My seven siblings and I grew up on a farm in southern Wisconsin. Dad's parents, who immigrated from Norway, also lived with us. Our grandparents spoke longingly of what they called the old country, describing Norway's majestic mountains and fjords and the siblings left behind. In 1960, when I was 10, my oldest sister, Audrey, embarked on an unusual adventure for a woman in her early 20s. She and cousin Nancy traveled by ship to Norway. There, they bought bicycles and spent 3 months traversing southern farmlands and northern fishing villages over the mountains and along fjords. When summer ended, Audrey was in love with Norway and not ready to leave, so smitten that she arranged to work at a youth hostel in the Rama Valley. In exchange, the owner's teenage son, Hans, would return home with her the following year to experience life on a Wisconsin farm while attending high school. At the hostel, Audrey became acquainted with Arne, a good friend of her Norwegian host's. Everyone in the village enjoyed listening to his stories, and this included Audrey, even though she didn't understand his Norwegian. Despite the language barrier, they were drawn together by a shared passion for music, mountains, and the fjords. And as Audrey learned the language, their friendship grew. One spring day, Arne invited her to join him for a Sunday drive with friends from England. It never occurred to her that the invitation was anything more than showing an American tourist the countryside, or that visiting his family was for the purpose of introducing her. The trip made her realize they had even more in common. Like her, Arne was one of eight siblings and had grown up on a farm. But after 10 months, the time had come for Audrey's fairy tale to end. She had to return to the U.S., taking Hans with her. Driving to Oslo, where they would board the ship, Hans decided that his girlfriend, Arne's niece, should take the train to send them off. After their goodbyes at the dock, she could ride home with her uncle. Alas, the ship sailed before either arrived. Day turned to night as their ship sailed down the Norwegian coast, making the last stop, hours later, in Kristiansand, before heading to the U.S. As the ship docked, Audrey and Hans could not believe their eyes. There stood Arne and his niece on the pier, waving. She knew he drove fast, but this was unbelievable. Arne rushed to Audrey before she got down the ramp. As they embraced, people watching from the sidelines clapped for their joyous reunion. The farewell was magical as Audrey reboarded the ship wearing a thin gold band. And a couple of short ones. I like this one from Ann Capron in Sheffield, Texas. A friend fixed me up on a blind date with a guy named Calvin. I tried name association to remember it. Calvin Coolidge. But when I said goodnight, the only president I could think of was Grover Cleveland. And on September 30th, I reluctantly went on a blind date with Norman. 2 weeks later, he proposed. I asked him what took so long. That from Donna Ruby Osterkamp in Middle River, Maryland. And now we're going on to cooking for a cause. Old family recipe fuels the fundraiser. When it came to spaghetti dinners, our family knew all of the ins and outs. By Joan Shane, Bakersfield, California. 8 years younger than me, my sister Mandy went to St. Anne's Hospital School of Nursing on Chicago's Northwest Side. She was elected president of her class and, as a fundraising activity, volunteered our family to cook a spaghetti dinner for 200 people, including doctors and nurses. My mom, Mary Bleizeffer, and grandmother, Ida Santillo, and I have cooked a lot of spaghetti dinners, but never for such a huge crowd. But we jumped at the chance to help out. We decided on the menu of spaghetti with 400 meatballs, green salad, garlic bread, and cream puffs, 400, and wrote the shopping list. We also assigned a responsibility chart, and along with Mrs. Spatafor from the school, when and how to get it all done. We set up long tables, family style, in the auditorium. The cooking was done on three separate floors. Graham was on one floor stirring the sauce, Mom on another cooking the pasta. I was in charge of salads, huge barrels of the stuff. What a joy it was to cook with them. Along the way, Mrs. Spatafor and Mom had a difference of opinion. You see, in our family, we never added onions, carrots, celery, or sugar to our gravy, as some Italians affectionately call sauce. So when Mrs. Spatafor suggested adding sugar, my mom replied, "No way." Another battle was how much to charge for the dinner. One of the nuns wanted to charge 75 cents, to which Mom said, "No way am I going through all of the trouble of making an entire meal for a mere 75 cents. It's $1.50 or we walk." Mom does not back down from her beliefs. She won that battle as well. After all was done, it was the best fundraiser in the history of the school. In fact, it was so successful we ran out of sauce and meatballs while we were selling takeout. Box Supper Bombshell by Auction Time, Everyone Knew the Secret of the Colored Ribbons by Neil Murphy, St. Augustine, Texas. Box Supper weather occurs in the late fall before winter starts. Usually by this time of year, there's already been a killing frost, so the trees are enriched by beautiful colors. The watermelons and gardens are long gone, and pumpkin can be seen along the turnip patches, yet not harvested. During this special time of year, most schools in the country where I grew up would have a box supper. This was a favorite means of raising money. The young ladies of the school district decorated boxes and filled them with homemade cookies, pies, sandwiches, and even full meals. Inside each box, the woman would include a piece of paper with her name. At a specified time, they would secretly deliver the boxes to the school so no one would guess whose box belonged to whom. The boxes were auctioned to raise money. Naturally, the married men knew which was their wives and were expected to bid on it. The real competition was among unmarried men who would bid on the most attractive box and share the contents with the young lady who had brought it. Sometimes real dates would ensue. One of my teachers, Anne, had a boyfriend, Fred. The day of the box supper, my friends Bill and John overheard a conversation between the couple. Anne told Fred that her box would have a red, white, and blue ribbon on top of a white handle. He couldn't miss it. Bill and John immediately spread the news to the other young men in town who were interested in bidding for Miss Anne's box supper, but they didn't stop there. They also persuaded several young ladies to decorate their boxes the same way. Now the stage was set. Bidding at the box supper that night was frantic. Six similar decorated boxes were auctioned off, and Fred was outbid on all but the last one. When the final box with the very pretty patriotic ribbon came up, Fred bid 25 cents and won because everyone else had spent their money on the counterfeit boxes. He was lucky enough to get the one made by Miss Anne. Bill and John, watching from the sidelines, laughed hysterically. For the first time, a teacher's box sold for a low bid. Even so, the evening raised more money than anyone could remember. It was a success, and everyone found their box supper, cooks, and enjoyed the evening. Box suppers were a highlight in our rural community. There were an inexpensive kind of entertainment that gave us a reason to get together, taking our minds off the problems of making a living. And now, oh, my sister can help you. Look-alike servers confuse the congregation by Dee Dee Hammond, Zephyrsville, Florida. Reverend Frank Parker, a legend among area folks, and his wife, our Aunt Al, were host and hostess for the Saturday evening baked bean supper sponsored by the Chichester Congregational Church in Chichester, New Hampshire, many years ago. When we were teenagers, my sister Polly and I often pitched in and waited on tables. In spite of a 3-year difference in our ages, many people, Mom included, had trouble telling us apart. Once we decided it would be fun to dress alike and confuse the folks at our tables. Whenever someone asked for something from the kitchen, we responded, "Oh, I'll tell my sister. She's assigned to your table." Much to our delight, it worked. Aunt Al smiled and shook her head at us, realizing what we were up to. She glanced around the room to make sure everything was in order before heading back to lend a hand in the kitchen. She knew our prank was harmless. The busy room hummed with eager voices. Reverend Parker welcomed regulars and newcomers alike. We placed platters of potato salad trimmed with sprigs of parsley on the tables. We filled water glasses and took orders for coffee or iced tea. When we brought out the steaming bowls of baked beans and baskets of soft rolls, conversation suspended for a short while. Hearty eaters dipped into their second helpings as the clock slowly ticked away. Dessert consisted of apple, pumpkin, lemon meringue, custard, and cherry pies, along with an assortment of cakes. Two, even three helpings of pie and cake made their way to the tables, along with refills of coffee. Finally, those at the table pushed back their chairs, slipped on their wraps, and got up to leave, uttering sincere promises to come again. With a surge of activity, Polly and I hurried to reset the tables as more people crowded in for their supper, and we delivered more food as a light breeze stirred the tablecloths. And here's a bit of a short one. Save some kraut for us. The latter part of the 1900s, we lived in a town 30 miles southwest of Chicago. We attended and supported a small Lutheran church that was known as the church by the ball field that has the sauerkraut dinner. One fall, after my wife, mom, three teenage sons, and I helped prepare and serve the meal, we were ready ourselves to eat, but there was no food left. I had to take the family to a smorgasbord restaurant in town 5 miles away. And I'm going to finish up with some tops in entertainment from the year 1951. See if you remember these. Academy Award, the best motion picture was All About Eve. The Emmy Awards, the best game show was Truth or Consequences. The best variety show, The Alan Young Show. And the Tony Awards, best musical, Guys and Dolls. Billboard Top 100 Song of the Year was Too Young by Nat King Cole. And the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry went to Complete Poems by Carl Sandburg. World Series, New York Yankees defeated the New York Giants 4-2. The MVP on the American League was Yogi Berra from the New York Yankees. The MVP on the National League was Roy Campanella, the Brooklyn Dodgers. World Figure Skating Championship male was Dick Button from the USA. The Kentucky Derby winner was Count Turf. And the Masters Golf Tournament champion was Ben Hogan. Well, I hope that you have enjoyed these reminiscings and that perhaps they have inspired a reminiscence or two of your own. Mine is of the spaghetti and pancake suppers we had in high school in Vestal, New York, to help send our band to Washington, D.C. for the Cherry Blossom Festival in the early 1960s. Both the dinners and the trips were successful. One year, we came in first in marching band and concert band. It was a great time. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for this show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you'll join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.